may we offer an unusual radio feature to you in your home and wherever you are in the radio audience. It is a message from a great American, Mr. William Randolph Hearst. It will be delivered to you by another noted American, a former cabinet member in the administration of the late President Woodrow Wilson. It is my distinct privilege and pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Bainbridge Colby, former Secretary of State. Mr. Colby.
I am sorry that it is not possible for this stirring message from Mr. Hearst to reach you in the tones of his own voice. His absence at the present time in Europe makes that impossible. I am very much honored, however, that he should have asked me to deliver his message. There is no man more devoted to his country, to all that makes for its honor, independence, freedom, and well-being, than William Randolph Hearst. Behind every word of his is a lifetime of consistent service to American ideals. When he speaks, it is with clear reasoning, sound sense, and absolute sincerity. It is little wonder that his words are listened to with respect throughout the country. He stands for America. He fights for American principles. His words, which I shall read, are preceded by the title, A Criticism and a Creed. They are addressed to sober and thoughtful America. Says Mr. Hearst, President Roosevelt has a complicated and highly technical job to perform. We all want to help him in every way. The question merely is, what is the best way to help him? There are perhaps two ways. One way is to approve everything that he does, regardless of whether we believe it to be right or wrong. The other way is heartily to applaud everything we think is beneficial, but to debate policies we believe to be harmful and try logically to convince him that he should pursue a different course. There is something to be said in favor of either way of helping Mr. Roosevelt. But for a newspaper man, it would seem that the only honest way is the second way, the discriminating way. Mr. Roosevelt may not pay a great deal of attention to the newspapers, but he may pay some attention to them. And if the newspapers mislead him, they are not helping him. And what is even more important, not helping the country. There can be no proper question of Mr. Roosevelt's purposes. The only intelligent criticism would be of his method. Is he taking the right way to put his good intentions into practical operation? To begin with, has he the right kind of sound and sincere, capable and experienced men around him? If you are ill, you get the best and most practical doctor or surgeon that you can find. If you want your house strengthened or beautified, you get the most competent and experienced architect or engineer that you can find. If you even want your plumbing attended to, or your dog doctored, you get competent and experienced people to do it. Why not apply that principle to politics? Why call in a lot of visionary theorists and let them experiment with serious situations? Why say, well, if these plans do not work, we will try some others? Are the other plans to be furnished by the same visionary theorists? We cannot experiment too much with any important situation. We cannot be like the aviator who bought a parachute. Suppose this blame thing doesn't work, said he. Oh, bring it back and we will give you another, replied the seller. We cannot always bring the parachute back. We are not always in a position to try some other plan. If inexperienced surgeons cut off the wrong leg, they may be willing to try another experiment on the other leg. But that does not help us much to give us our legs back. Moreover, at the rate our government is dissipating the country's resources and putting us into debt, we will not be able to try another and more practicable plan. After the visionary theorists have exhausted our treasury and destroyed our credit, we will have to spend the rest of our lives paying for their failure. A practicable plan now is what we want, not a lot of visionary theories now, and a practicable plan when it is too late. And you men who are working on the road need the practicable plan for permanent benefit just as much as the businessmen do. President Roosevelt's illustrious namesake and predecessor once wrote to a captain of industry, "You and I are practical men." There was no just criticism of that expression, no proper complaint of the idea it conveyed. We all want practical men at the head of business, and of industry as well, and particularly at the head of the nation's business. We want honest men, but practical men. We want practicable plans for the conduct of the nation's affairs and for the improvement of our individual condition. What do we mean by a practicable plan? According to the dictionary, practicable means workable. That is what we need, not visionary and sometimes revolutionary theories, not impracticable and sometimes unpatriotic experiments, but homely, American, workaday, workable, practicable plan. Fantastic innovations are of dubious value. Good intentions are not sufficient in themselves. An old proverb says the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We may be full of good intentions and still be on the road to hell. Sometimes it looks as if we were. The sublime self-confidence and self-satisfaction of the theorists are not altogether reassuring. They suggest too much the old story of the pilot who took charge of a ship to steer it into a safe harbor. "You know the channel thoroughly?" asked the captain. "You bet I do," said the pilot. "I know every rock in the harbor." "There," said he, as the ship struck. "There is one of them now." We don't want a pilot who, in supreme self-confidence, runs us on the rocks and then is willing to try another plan. You and I, fellow citizens, are practical men, and we want practical pilots. We are like the man who is engaging a chauffeur for his automobile. "How close can you go to the edge of a bridge?" he asked the candidates for the position. "Oh, within about a foot," said one. "Maybe within an inch," said another. "I don't know," said a third. "I always keep on the safe part of the bridge." "You are engaged," said the owner. "I don't want any chauffeur making dangerous experiments with my property and my life." Fellow citizens, maybe we too want chauffeurs who will stick to the safe part of the bridge. The good old American part, which has carried us safely over so many depressions for so many years. Maybe if we get too close to the experimental edge, we may go over and into the stream. Then it might be too late to try another plan. I do not write as a reactionary. Good Lord, think of what the reactionaries have called me in my day. I am not even a conservative, unless a conservative is one who desires to conserve American principles and institutions. I am definitely progressive, but a practical progressive like dear old Theodore. I was a progressive before Franklin D. was born. I advocated the remonetization of silver, and when the reactionaries took their advertisements out of my paper because I was supporting Bryan, I thanked them and told them that they had given me that much more room to support Bryan in. I advocated the election of senators by the people and the direct primary. I advocated woman suffrage. And in fact, I have in the past 50 years of my newspaper activities supported every sound progressive man and measure before the American people. My father before me was a progressive. His only creed was the public good. My mother's creed was public education and human sympathy. I would not sacrifice one jot or tittle of those principles. In fact, I am so devoted to truly American ideals that I want to be sure that we are attaining them and retaining them, and through practical American men and means. I want to be sure that we are preserving the American principles and the American methods my forefathers and your forefathers labored to create. I am positively a progressive, but primarily an American, And I do not believe in radical revolution, either in theory or in the un-American practice of minority rule by force and violence. I and every other progressive believe in the welfare of the workers. We believe in good wages and good working conditions. But we believe, too, that the American industries and industrialists that have given American labor the highest standard of wages and of living in the world are also worthy of the consideration of enlightened government. These industries and industrialists should be appreciated and encouraged to further achievement for the benefit of labor and for the advantage of the whole people. They should not be discredited at home and abroad by unfair accusations, which can justly apply only to a miserable few. I am a militant progressive, and I do not believe in protecting crooked businessmen any more than I believe in protecting crooked politicians. Yet I do not believe in holding crooked businessmen up to America and to the world as typical examples of American national life. Put the crooks of all classes and conditions in jail. Put more of them in jail. Put all of them in jail. But encourage honest business and stimulate honest businessmen. That is the best way to create national prosperity and the only way to create permanent employment. I stand solidly for proved American practices and policies and principles. I am opposed to revolutionary theories. I am averse to inexperienced surgical experiments on the vital parts of our industrial anatomy. I am equally averse to ill-considered architectural experiments on the foundations of our American house and home. I do not even think it helpful to tinker unscientifically with the political plumbing, or wise to try fool theories even on the dog. Anyhow, I prefer a good, dependable domestic dog to any unbalanced, speculative political theory. And I wish our good president would get rid of his revolutionary communist advisors and unpractical, un-American, experimentalist, while we still have money enough left to feed the dog.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard Mr. Bainbridge Colby, former Secretary of State in President Wilson's cabinet. He brought to you a message from Mr. William Randolph Hearst.